You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Hello, Alan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thanks, Shamina.
Fantastic. Alan has joined us in studio with a slick new haircut. He's ready to go today. First up today, we're looking at how a new study has found that students using cannabis fail university courses more often. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Indeed. This is an interesting study with a little bit of history behind it. And this is from the University of Maastricht. I think I pronounced that vaguely correctly, in the Netherlands. And this university just happens to be very, very close to the border of Belgium and France and Germany.
Mm.
And what citizens of said countries tend to do, because dope is legal in the Netherlands, is they pop across the border for a quick smoke and head back. And so the citizens of Maastricht got a little bit pissed off by this. And so what they...
I feel like, because I used to live in the Netherlands and I remember that there were specific sort of coffee shops that were, you know, quite close to the border so that people could do that. Surely that's like a, you know, good for business, right?
You would have thought so. Well, apparently it's too good for business. And they got a bit pissed off. And so what they then decided to do was to restrict access to the coffee shops just for citizens only, so for people from the Netherlands.
Mm. Oh, I think I do remember this as well. Hearing about it, because this was a little while ago.
Well, the study seems to have just come out, but again,
those
that doesn't
changes,
mean to say that...
I think they happened a little while ago.
Yeah.
But yes, continue.
So... A couple of economists thought, oh, hang on, this could be a good study, because what this means is that the kids at the university, so all of the citizens at the university, will still have access to the coffee shops, and all the foreign students won't. So let's do a study and see how they go after this ban is implemented. And so they did that. They had a sample size of about 4,000 students, and they looked at their grades basically after the banning of the coffee shops to the foreign students, and what they found was that there was a noticeable increase in the foreign students' grades as soon as their access to the coffee shops was restricted, which is kind of interesting. And even more interesting, if you were young or if you were underperforming or if you were a female, then the improvement in your grades was even better than average. So they're talking about a 5% better chance of passing your exams if you're not smoking dope. So...
Can you just isolate that factor, though? Because, I don't know, surely they must spend, you know, time crossing the border and, you know, all of that time that they could actually be spending studying that, as opposed to actually the practice of smoking weed. You know, like maybe if they had weed legal in their country, the grades wouldn't have... there wouldn't have been such a distinction.
Well, that's another study, isn't it?
I'm just speculating here.
Well, you know, that's the problem with any study. How do you separate out all of the possible other factors from this one particular factor that you're looking at? And, I mean, that's beyond me. I'm certainly not a statistician. I really don't understand all of this stuff. But, you know, this is what these couple of economists... So there's a couple of economists from the University of Bonn and the University of Rotterdam. So these are the guys who've done the study. I guess they're the people to ask, I suppose. But, you know, it's been published, certainly. So that's a sign that their peers think that this is worthy of publication. They think that the methods are robust. So, therefore, it's out there in the literature, and it remains to be either, supported or refuted by other studies, which is the way that such things always... go. There's never a definitive study in all of this sort of, dare I call it, social science type of things. Studies always lead to more questions, seemingly.
Which is great. Love it.
Well, it certainly keeps everyone in business, doesn't it?
So I'm wondering, though, also with the study, does it seem to imply that there is some causation here, or it's just like, this is just a correlation, we're not making any big claims here?
And again, that's probably the thing that you can't really say, would be my view on that. So, who knows?
Yeah.
But as I say, you know, it's out there, and there have been lots of studies on the effect of dope on academic performance, and some say yes and some say no. So, you know, this is another one of those studies that's adding to the no side of the equation, I guess.
Yeah.
I find the interesting thing about this study is, like, a lot of the articles that have been put up are saying that the title implies that there is a direct correlation. It's like,
yeah, I think that's probably a fair comment. Yes, yes, so because sort of, you know, obviously the media want certainty, don't they? They they want the clickbait and all of that. So, you know, let's put it in the strongest possible terms: you smoke dope, you'll fail.
Yeah,
and that's not what it's saying, really. It's saying there's an increased chance, a 5% chance,
which is 5% isn't huge.
It's not, but it's obviously it's of an amount that is important. You know,
yeah.
It's not 0.1%. It's 5%. It's small, but it's obviously something that is important, I suppose. Mm. So yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, often I guess that is the case with so much research that the way in which it gets depicted in the media, and this is our responsibility to, you know, actually, you know, talk about it in the way that it, the findings that were actually concluded in the research, as opposed to turning it around into this big sort of claim.
Absolutely. And, you know, we've got 5 minutes to talk about it, whereas, you know, the, I don't know, your online places and everything, they've got a headline. And that's what they've got to go on. So if it's not something that's going to grab you straight away, then people aren't going to read it. So.
And if they have something like maybe or might, that's way less grabbing. People are way less likely to click on that.
But that's the truth. You know, this is all probability. This 5% probability doesn't mean to say it's, you know,
a definite.
It's a probability. Mm. So it'll work for some people. It won't work for others, et cetera, et cetera. But overall, there's that 5% probability you're going to do better if you're not smoking dope.
Mm. I mean, I guess that's also a thing, though, that it's not just the media who like to have certainty in headlines. That's driven also by consumers as well, right? That they look to the media for answers. They don't want maybes. You know, they.
You're absolutely right. I can't argue with that. Yes.
Therein lies the problem.
Indeed.
Just solving all the big issues of the world on Dear Science.
See, that's the problem with being informed. Once you become informed, you start seeing shades of grey. You know, things aren't black and white anymore. You know,
and you can never go back.
Yeah, indeed. Yes.
Mm. And so also today we're talking about how Labour's Stuart Nash is wanting to replace chlorine with ozone as a means of making drinking water safer in Napier.
Okay, now, I probably wouldn't disagree with him on this particular one. He had an article in the Herald on Saturday where he said, quote-unquote, permanent chlorination not needed. That's the headline, that's the clickbait there. And so what I want to do is to quote what he was saying. So he's talking about the fact that chlorine is not particularly effective. It kills 60% of bugs. So this is all in reply to the big debacle down in Havelock North, which was it this year or last year? I can't remember. Where they had an E. coli infection and like 1,000 or 2,000 people ended up with going to the hospital. It was just terrible because their drinking water had been infected by runoff from a dairy farm, I think
it was last year.
Yeah. And so he's talking about this and saying, right, you know, we want pure water. Hell, who doesn't? I mean, you know, it's a very, very sensible thing. So how do we get that? And his quote is, if the question is how do we ensure safe drinking water, the answer is certainly not add chemicals. And then he then goes on to say that there are two alternative solutions that will deliver safe, chemical-free drinking water. And the first one is to make sure your infrastructure is up to date. The second one, and I quote, the second requires 21st century thinking. Treating the water with ozone kills 100% of the microbes that can potentially cause harm. It is chemical free and completely safe. Right, so as a chemist, I could talk about this for, oh my goodness, the rest of the afternoon probably. Okay, number one, there's no such thing as chemical free, okay? Number two, ozone, completely safe. No, it's not. That's why you're putting it in the bloody drinking water to kill the bugs. Mm. And if something can kill bugs, chances are it can probably do us a little bit of damage as well. Certainly chlorine can. Chlorine is a very, very strong oxidizing agent. The world's first chemical weapon, in fact. it was used in the First World War by the Germans. They used chlorine gas to kill the Allies in about 1916. So, yes, chlorine is potentially nasty, but God knows how many lives it saved by people putting it in the water, because it kills, not necessarily 100%, but it certainly kills the bugs. Yes, it's a chemical, okay? Ozone is an extraordinarily strong oxidizing agent. We think of chlorine being a good oxidizing agent, a good bleach. You know, that's another name for sort of chlorine. We talk about chlorine bleach. Ozone is even stronger. Ozone is an extraordinarily reactive chemical species. Okay? It is a chemical. Of course it is. Everything on the damn planet is a chemical. Mm. Okay, so don't spout this crap about things being chemical free.
Yeah.
Because they ain't, okay? Now, it's a very effective method of water treatment as well. And it doesn't leave sort of nasty residues because the byproduct is oxygen, which is all good as we know. So he's being very, very disingenuous here. And I just hate it when people talk about chemical free. This, and okay, he's an MP, he should know better, basically.
Mm.
He just should. I looked him up. He's got a master's degree in law, forestry science and management from Canterbury. He's Walter Nash's great-grandson, as everybody knows. And sadly, dare I say it, he's the ex-director of strategic development at AUT.
Right. Which, so you think, like, Stuart, you should know better about this.
You absolutely should know better, and you should be called out about this. You really should. People look up to you. You're in charge of the damn country. So come on. Don't spout this rubbish about chemical-free nonsense. And as I say, this harks back to a couple of famous incidents in the early 2000s. Jackie Dean, who was the national candidate for the Otago electorate, she called for a banning of a substance called DHMO, as did the Greens, one of Sue Kedgley's staffers way back in 2001, also called for a banning of the stuff called DHMO, which is all over the planet. They've found samples of DHMO from Mount Everest to the lowest point in the Marianas Trench. It's everywhere. It's covering the planet. Accidental ingestion of this stuff will kill you. It kills about 100 New Zealanders a year. It's in all nuclear waste. We pump literally tons and tons of it out into the Hauraki Gulf every year. And, you know, this is why people were calling for banning of this. DHMO, dihydrogen monoxide, water. So these people were calling for banning water, okay? You know, and this is similarly, dare I say, it's stupid. It just is. Everything is a chemical.
Mm.
And, you know, if you don't get that, have a chat to a chemist. I'm available. Give me a call if you want to know something about all this stuff. But please, please, please don't go to the media and talk about chemical free, because this just perpetuates the utter crap that we get in advertising and everything about things being chemical free.
Mm.
So please, please, please.
So, Alan, when Nash says it will kill 100% of bugs as well, is that something you can say for 100%? I feel like 100% is a very big call to make.
Yeah, I think 100% is a very big call to make as well. Yes, yeah. You can kill 100% of anything probably if you give it a high enough concentration. So if you up the chlorine concentration, you can kill 100% of bugs probably with chlorine, but it's not going to be the best for you, okay? Ozone, same sort of thing. You're going to have to go to a particular concentration to kill 100% of the bugs. The thing about chlorine, he's saying that it's sort of perfectly safe. No, 50 parts per million of chlorine in the air, 50 parts per million of ozone in the air for 30 minutes will probably kill you, okay? 50 parts per million isn't a lot. You'll know the smell of ozone if you've ever sort of stood next to a photocopier. It's sharp smell, but that's ozone. And photocopiers sort of do generate ozone. We've got the ozone layer. That's there because it's very reactive and it keeps us safe from all of the cosmic rays and stuff like that. It absorbs those and then breaks into harmless materials. But it's still a chemical.
And so why is he like, yes, ozone good, chlorine bad? Is ozone seen to, I don't know, is chlorine because it's, you know, put it in pools that seem to be toxic, like quote unquote toxic versus ozone is more natural.
Well, that's his problem because he thinks that ozone's not a chemical. that's the problem.
Right. So he's more like, this is more natural because it's not a chemical, when actually that makes zero sense.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. So please, Stuart, if you're listening.
Stuart.
Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess I feel like this comes up all of the time, that things, because they're seen as being more natural, therefore they're inherently good.
Oh, yes.
And it frustrates me to no end because it's just, you know, just because something is natural does not make it inherently good or healthy or non-toxic or any of those things.
Amen.
Yeah.
Couldn't have put that better myself. Absolutely true.
There are natural poisons that exist.
Oh, yes,
but
indeed.
But you're not going to put that in your coffee because it's organic.
Well, the most toxic thing known to humankind is a molecule that's found naturally in this rock pool in Hawaii, and about a teaspoon of it would kill Auckland.
Shit.
So if you put that in the water supply, you'd kill the whole entire city.
Yes, you would. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's a thing. It's a thing called paleotoxin. It's nasty.
How might one get a hold of this?
Take
if
this
one as
line,
myself
please.
Was wishing to find such a chemical.
Asking for a friend. And so finally today, we're looking at how researchers have been inspired by slug mucus and have developed new wound-mending glues that can work on bloody moving tissue.
Okay.
It sounds kind of gross, but also exciting.
It does, yeah. So obviously if you've had surgery or something like that and they've cut you open, then they've got to sort of stick you back together somehow. And sort of the time-honoured way of doing that used to be stitching people up, literally. But now they're looking at adhesives and glues and stuff like that to be able to just to stick the parts together, and hopefully that's going to hang together. So what,
and then so because it draws it together, then it kind of mends itself.
Yeah,
and
indeed.
As
yeah.
opposed
so
to like stitches.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're holding it together while it mends, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what you want is something that obviously works in a wet environment or a bloody environment, obviously, because the inside of you is.
Mm-hmm.
And you want something that is relatively flexible because the inside of you is, again, mobile. So you don't want a very, very rigid sort of adhesive because that's just not going to do the trick. So things like super glue, for example, if anybody's ever played with super glue and stuck it on their fingers, you will know that that sticks to skin really, really, really well, but it's not at all flexible. Okay, it's a very, very solid thing. And straight away too, it binds pretty much instantaneously, which is not what you want if you're a surgeon, because you've got to sort of slide this here and slide that there and everything. You don't want them binding, bam, straight as soon as they touch. So. People have been, I guess, investigating this for quite some time now. They're looking at developing these sorts of things. And there's some workers who were led by a team at Harvard very recently who've published a paper where they have developed an adhesive that satisfies all of these criteria. So it works in wet, bloody situations. It's mobile. And the way that they came up with this was by looking at the defensive mucus of slugs. Now, apparently when slugs get threatened, they expel this sort of really, really seriously sticky mucus. And so apparently the attacker then gets sort of all trapped up in this sticky mucus, and the slug makes its very, very slow get away.
I guess that's what you're going to do if you're a slug. You're
indeed.
Just got to make...
Go as fast as you
yeah,
can.
Yeah, make the other one slower than you.
So they were looking at the constitution of this sticky mucus, and basically what they found was that it was composed of two materials. The first sort of being a protein, a positively charged protein, and the second was this sort of flexible matrix. And the positively charged protein was the stuff that actually stuck, so it would bind to the negatively charged parts of sort of biological skin and stuff like that. And the matrix was there as sort of a protective agent. It sort of gave the whole thing flexibility and stopped it just sort of ripping off. So that was your flexibility component there. And so they found that the mucus was composed of that, and so they took bio-inspiration from that, and they have developed this new material that does exactly those things. So, and again, it's composed of two things. They've got this positively charged polymer now that they put in there, and again, they've got this matrix, which is a hydrogel. It's a gel in water, and that sort of allows flexibility and stuff like that. And they've found remarkable results. For example, they made a hole in a beating pig's heart, and then they filled it up with this stuff, and then the heart kept on beating and it didn't leak and everything. So quite incredible stuff. And so they found that it sticks to pig skin, they've found that it sticks to liver, heart, all sorts of parts of your innards, I guess. And, you know, wonderful results. Of course, it's not sort of commercially available yet, but the results are looking good. So this has just been published in the journal Science, which is the top sort of science journal out there. And it does what it says on the label sort of thing, I guess, that journal.
Yep.
And so this obviously will be an advance in for surgical techniques and stuff like that, I would imagine, in the not-too-distant future. But it's nice that we can kind of mimic nature. We can take inspiration from nature, because nature's been around for a few billion years longer, possibly, than humankind. So, if it's out there and they can do it better than us, then why not?
So let's be clear, though, that it's inspired by this goo.
It is not
slug mucus.
And
they're not just sort of lathering glue, slug mucus on patients' bodies. Okay.
Indeed. Yeah. Yes.
But essentially, if they did that, that would still have the same effect, right?
Well, potentially, I guess, but yeah, people might not be too thrilled about that, but yeah.
Wait, so when you say it's there to replace stitching, what benefits does it have over stitching? Is it the fact that you can plug holes with it more, or...?
I think probably that it's an instant, relatively instant sort of thing where you can just press the two things together and they are then stuck, and so there's going to be no leaks or anything like that, whereas with stitches, presumably... You've always got the potential of leaking and stuff like that, I would guess, not being a surgeon.
And also I assume it would be possibly, you know, a bit easier than going through the process of having to stitch
I don't know how the hell they do that. I think they're quite amazing. Yeah, especially with bloody, not holding it with your hands and everything. And doing it with
forceps. Another important question in my childish brain right now is how do they get this gooey stuff from the slugs? Are they like harvesting slugs?
They just frighten them.
So there's some guy who runs around shouting boo at slugs and just harvesting their goo
to learn from in their own sort of endeavours.
Well, the beauty is you don't need much goo to be able to, to investigate and find out what it's made of. So, you know, you don't need bloody gallons of it or anything. So, litres.
Good we point. Don't need any, like, slug rights groups or anything coming
No,
up.
Don't start that. No, no.
All right, well, thank you once again for joining us this week, Alan.
My pleasure.
We will talk to you again next week.
Will do. See ya.
That was Dear Science.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.